Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We have a fascinating show tonight, and we're going to be talking about the green burial, okay? And I know people don't run away. Like, I tried to run away when I first saw the book. It's going to be a very entertaining show in the sense of giving you a lot of information, very grounding, so that you can get past any fears or concerns you have about what happens after somebody leaves their body and what to do with it. So, you know, stay tuned because we're going to have a lot of useful, I'll get that out, and helpful information. Okay, so the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through the blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back, but the real question is, are you truly ready to? And by the way, folks, BS is belief system. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners. Intuitive since birth, I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I'm the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, the Men and Money book, and Masterful Choices, the Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the absolute fullest. Now, my clients say that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. Find out more about me and the services I offer by going to my website, MoniqueChapman.com. I invite you to like me on Facebook and follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter. You can also sign up for my opt-in newsletter, Intuitive Living, on my website. And again, that's MoniqueChapman.com. Excuse me. Death is often an uncomfortable topic for many people, and yet it is one of the few experiences that every single person in the entire world will go through. Planning for the end of your life can be scary, strange, and confusing, and navigating the funeral industry without solid information and knowledge can, you know, like, get in the way and sometimes be a very strong, daunting process. However, my guest tonight, Elizabeth Fournier, she's affectionately called the Green Reaper, and she's the author of the Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. She is the owner of the Cornerstone Funeral Services right outside of Portland, Oregon. She serves on the advisory board for the Green Burial Council, which sets the standards for green burial in Northern California. She lives on her farm with her husband and daughter and many goats, and you can find out more about her and her work. I'm going to give you 2 websites. The first one is ElizabethFournier.com, and let me spell that for you, ElizabethFournier.com or thegreenreaper.org. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Yes, and Monique, my goodness, the whole list of everything you have going on. Do you sleep? I imagine you do, huh?
A couple hours. You know, the older you get, I've discovered with, you know, getting older, the older you get, the less sleep kind of comes. So we appreciate those 4 hours a night. We truly do.
It's a strong 4 hours, yeah.
Yes, and what, you know, I need to share with the audience what I was sharing with you before we began. First of all, the Green Burial Guidebook, excellent book. Folks, when I first saw this and it came across my desk, I said, very interesting topic, but I have an issue with a dead body itself, so it scared the crap out of me. However, I said, you know, Monique, you need to get over this and at least look at it. So it took me a couple of days, and I finally opened up the book, and then once I did, it was like, oh my goodness, I actually read it cover to cover, right then and there. The information was so interesting, not scary at all, and a lot of informative information. So, Elizabeth, to start with, why don't you share with us exactly what is a green burial so we're all on the same page?
Sure. I think it's a really great place to start. So when people mention a green burial, what they're talking about is what we all did prior to the funeral industry being something so strong in our present mind of when somebody dies, the funeral home comes, takes your person, they prepare them and sell you an expensive casket, and you have an expensive grave space, and $10,000 later, your loved one is placed to rest. What we're doing with green burial is getting back to what we always did, which was having a body which is just stays in its natural state. Don't need to have any embalming, don't need to have any chemicals. And then that wonderful, natural body can be placed into a sustainable or biodegradable container, which would mean a simple pine box or a shroud or maybe some sort of cedar casket, just something which doesn't have a lot of metals and toxic glues and doesn't cost a lot of money. And then taking that natural body in that natural container and placing it into the ground. And the ground would either be a space in a cemetery, which isn't lined by a concrete grave liner, or maybe even if you have the luxury of burying in your own yard, you can do that too on private property, and that happens a lot across the United States.
Really?
So it's a matter of, it's always fun to bring that up.
Well, you know, I find that interesting because if you own the house and, you know, you bury Grandpa in the backyard and you sell the house, the new occupants are stuck with Grandpa?
Well, technically. I mean, they're stuck with Grandpa in the sense that, yes, you decided to have human remains buried as a full body in that yard. Now, if you're buried in a shroud or a cardboard box, you're going to become part of the earth. So Grandpa in his full form is not going to be there. However, the new person who comes along and buys that house and buys that land is now the owner of that parcel, in essence, the owner of what remains of Grandpa. And people are well aware of that when they buy a home, that somebody is buried there. And I guess if you set the correct vibration, there's many of us who would find that, well, maybe not you, because you've talked about your a little bit of comfort with the body, but there's a lot of us who would find that really, really fantastic and really magical to know that somebody laid somebody to rest and there they are. And if it was me, I'd go out and play my ukulele and my goats would visit and it would be beautiful.
And I would be running for the hills very quickly. It's even different when, you know, growing up you have pets and all that, and whenever a cat died, you know, we had a lot of acreage, so my father would bury it someplace, you know, on the property. And I could swear I'd hear that cat. I'd walk in a certain area and the cat's talking to me. I'm like, no. Now, but you bring up an interesting point. So Grandpa's in the backyard. You have to get permission, of course, from the city or county or whatever that you live in.
Yeah, how it works with the United States here is green burial is legal in all 50 states. However, every state has its jurisdictions of where a green burial can take place. Some states say, well, we really would like this to happen in a licensed and registered cemetery, which allows natural burial. Other states, like I happen to live in the beautiful state of Oregon, says, okay, well, every county can make their own rules and decide. The county I happen to be in, which I'm only 20 miles outside of downtown Portland, Oregon, my county says, sure, yeah, if you're rural and you've got an acre, you can do this. And there's other things we need to consider. We don't want to bury somebody in the middle of a watershed, or we don't want them to be very close to electricity, or maybe the neighbor's, you know, kitchen window, things like that. We want to, you know, use our discretion on choosing a space, but you betcha. I spend a lot of time with a backhoe or a sharp shovel in backyards burying my kinfolk out here in the country.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask you, since you live on a farm, if your kinfolk were buried on your property at all.
Well, I have a natural cemetery full of sheep, goats, birds, fish, ducks, and actually a doe.
Oh, wow.
A doe jumped into the goat pen one day, and it went there to die. I didn't realize that. She must have been separated from her pack, and she jumped in and walked around, and then we found her later that evening in the barn, and she was laying down, and we brought her some food and tried to, we actually left, she let us pet her. So that was the first sign that, okay, she's probably crossing over because she's allowing human interaction.
Yeah.
So yeah. We just sang. I have a little daughter who's very spiritual, and she came down and held the little hoof and sang some songs and just really tried to let the doe go cross over in a peaceful environment. We lit some candles, and then we decided, well, that the hard part was really going to be physically getting her out of that lean-to, bringing her up the hill behind the property, digging the space. So, but yes, we have a animal cemetery burial ground.
Oh, how wonderful, like Pet Cemetery. I thought of Stephen King, but anyway.
Oh, no,
just
it's
kidding,
beautiful.
Just kidding. No, I feel
I call out the kitchen window. I call their names. I say hello. We grow wildflowers. It's beautiful.
Oh, I bet it is. I truly bet it is. And the wonderful thing, you're providing a wonderful space for the souls of the animals should they decide to come back and visit and be, you know, because I truly believe that once you your body is no longer functioning, that your soul moves on or is free, and, you know, you're not really attached to that physical. And, you know, if you want to come back and visit it, you can. But let me ask you, why do people call you the Green Reaper?
That name came along, and it wasn't something I invented. I almost get embarrassed when people will say she's the self-proclaimed Green Reaper, because it's, you know, it's kind of a funny name if you think about it. But it came from a spinoff of the Grim Reaper. We think of the Grim Reaper as a dark clothes, and he has a cloak and a spice, and he's coming to get you and whisk you away from your happy moment in your life because your clock is up. Time has come. And Green Reaper was something that I was just referred to locally here in the community because I would be talking to people about having this burial in their yard or on private property. I'd be out in people's houses, and we'd be walking through their bamboo or through their lilacs and all of this. And it just became, I became known as a sort of softer, more natural green version of this person who helps people crawl over. So if you just say Green Reaper, people don't know if I'm a big Kubota tractor or if they're talking about marijuana. They don't know what that is. And then when they see me, they say, oh, okay, so you're sort of that death person, but it's sort of that nice nickname. And yeah, I find it very flattering. I like it a lot.
Well, you know, folks, go to her website. I'm looking right now at thegreenreaper.org, and you'll see a picture of Miss Elizabeth. She's absolutely gorgeous, and as you can tell from her voice, she's very grounded and grounding, and you get this energy of trust around her. So if you have any thoughts about the typical mortician, you know, dressed in black and really skinny and kind of like gaunt-looking and scary, okay, she greened it up a lot, and she's absolutely good at embodying the energy of life, you know. And think about it, Elizabeth, when you hear the word green, you think life, you know.
Yeah, and positive, it's a great color, yeah.
And you're helping people with, you know, who have moved on, you know, physically, to kind of put their remains, if you will, at rest. Now, you've been in the mortuary business a while. How did you get started in this?
You know, as a young kid, that's really what the starting point that I really always have to go back to. What happened was, when I was very young, my mother was very, very sick. And unbeknownst to me, she was dying. My father kept that from me, but she was in and out of the hospital. My father's parents moved in with us because they were elderly and he was an only child, and they were aged and going through their process. And so in a very short period of time, all three of those people who were very close to me in my formative years slowly got very sick and died. And it became very profound. I was the only kid I knew that had that sort of experience. It sort of became a normal to me where I would be in the sandbox, and how I'd be processing this grief is I'd be playing with the dolls, and I'd set up a funeral, and I'd dig a little grave. And I knew my other friends weren't doing that, but in my life, that was normal. I'd collect little rocks and things, and on top of my headboard, I would make a little cemetery. So I went through some time doing that. And I became somebody who people would come to if they had their pet die or grandma was sick and they thought grandma was dying. I just became this sort of comforting person. So I think at a pretty early age, I knew this was the path that was chosen for me. And I started exploring this more when I was in college. I lived in a cemetery. I was a night keeper. And then when I graduated from college, I went on, and that's when I really became more involved in getting full-time work in the industry.
Okay. I got to ask this question. Does that pay well?
That's a great question. I really love that question because I do have young men and women who come in who want to have interviews with me, and either they are interested in this job because they like that whole goth, funky aspect of it, or they think it's going to be something which pays extraordinarily well because nobody wants to deal with the death of a loved one, and nobody wants to deal with a body and deal with the bereaved. The funeral industry has changed a lot. You used to see these really big parlors, and they would have men in very nice suits, and you'd see the, you know, beautiful rooms, and they'd have these big showrooms of caskets and these gorgeous hearses and family cars out front. Mm-hmm. Funeral homes have changed quite a bit, where most people don't even have their own hearse. They don't have these big buildings anymore. A lot of funeral homes, especially on the West Coast, you can find these in strip malls. It's become a lot more of a casual, torn-down sort of business. Mm-hmm. So I would say, if you're looking at making money in the funeral industry, you'd have to become a heck of a salesperson who really wants to sell those top-notch caskets to people, or probably if you owned your own funeral parlor. If you just decide to get in, you're going to help people, you're going to help with some bereavement, and you're going to do your thing. You know, I think it's a living wage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I asked because, you know, I've known people in your industry, and you never know. I mean, I've never asked anyone in the industry except you, and you just never know. You think that it's, you know, extremely well paid for the reasons that you mentioned moments ago, but, you know, you just never know. And I have to tell you, I have a cousin, actually she's a pretend cousin down in Alabama where my parents would send us every summer when we were little to my Aunt Coco's, and next door was a girl named Brenda. And Brenda was maybe about 2 years older than me, but she knew as a child she wanted to be a mortician. Yeah, I never asked her why. I mean, she was full of life and all of that, but she knew as a child, and guess what? She is a thriving mortician to this day.
Right.
And I'm like, well, good for you, girl, but no, not for me. Okay. Well, folks, we are speaking with Elizabeth Fournier. She is the author of The Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. You can check her websites out, and that is ElizabethFournier.com. Let me spell that for you. ElizabethFournier.com or thegreenreaper.org. And check it out because it's really user-friendly, okay, and you get a lot of information. Now, Elizabeth, we talked about, you know, the green burial being legal and it's ethical, but how safe is it?
Well, dealing with the human body normally is very safe. There's very rare situations where you're going to have somebody who's dying of a very contagious disease, a Jakob-Kreutzfeld situation, or an AIDS-related virus or something where you have to use some extra precautions. Ultimately, a body stops its life function, and slowly it's going to go back into the form of being part of the earth. It's really the ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We want to go back to where we were. So it's safe, it's fine. I think if we're going to be burying a body on private land, we always look for regulations to make sure we're doing everything okay. We want to make sure there's enough topsoil so things aren't going to fly away. There isn't going to be animals needing to come out and look around. Mm-hmm. People that want to handle their loved ones pretty much are pretty comfortable with it because it's their person, it's that person they loved, so it doesn't seem so foreign and so scary. So in general, all of the barriers aren't really there. I just think we've set this up that the funeral director, the mortician, the undertaker whisks your person away as soon as they pass away. They get them from the hospital, the nursing home, the private home, and you don't have that time to really be hands-on. And when people realize that they have the right to go into a funeral home and have a little sponge in their hand and kind of dab at the skin and give a little bath of someone they love, or maybe even dress them, or maybe even load them up in their own vehicle and transport them to the funeral home, I think people realize that's such an empowerment, and that really taps into really helping them move forward in the grief process.
Yeah, to me that would set a true reality that, yes, the person is no longer here in the physical, and it would help you, you know, come to terms with that a bit quicker, I would think. Now, could you walk us through the steps that happen to a body after a person passes on? Because I was really surprised about the rigor mortis thing. That really, you know, caught my attention. But please walk us through the steps.
Sure. So what we have done in the funeral industry for years is when somebody passes away, primarily within 24 hours, we either embalm them, we get them into refrigeration, we cremate them, or we bury them. A lot of times people decide that they want to keep their loved one at home because in a lot of states you can act as your own funeral director, you can take care of things, you can be in charge. Or people decide they want to wait a little bit until the funeral home comes because they want other people to come. They might want to pick out clothing or have more time to say goodbye, all of those. So in the book, there is... You know, I'm pretty clear on how you wash somebody, move somebody, handle somebody. And there's also the section of rigor mortis like you're talking about. And ultimately, bodies will temporarily, the joints and the muscles, they'll all stiffen a couple hours after death. This happens, you know, can happen up to a couple days. Basically, it makes maneuvering a body sometimes a little bit tricky. If somebody is in a little bit of a stiffer position. But really what happens is maybe the first 3 hours of death, the body's still pretty warm and flexible. About 3 to 8 hours after death, the body still is warm, yet the limbs become a little bit to stiffen up a little bit. So whatever position they're in, they're going to be a little bit harder to move. A lot of times the natural position of somebody is either you'll put their hands down by their sides, or maybe that idea of, well, we'll clasp their hands together in sort of prayer form about their waist. That seems a little bit comfortable. So that once that happens, you're a little bit in that position. So let's say at that point, 8 hours, maybe up to 72 hours, the body becomes a lot cooler, and then the body becomes a lot stiffer. So whatever position they're in, they pretty much are in that position. But it is interesting that after a while, those muscles relax and the body isn't really stiff. So maybe 2-3 days after death, the body will loosen up a bit. And then at that point, what happens is that's when you see some of the changes in the body. The body, ultimately, what's inside, the liquids, all of those things really sort of want to come out. But I don't want to be too graphic because I think people are tuned into your people are tuned into your show not to be shocked or not to feel uncomfortable, and like you've been very honest, Monique, the idea of a body is a little off-putting for you. So ultimately, when it gets to be a couple days down the road, that's when we sort of decide, okay, are we ready to have a burial at this point? Let's look at some some ways to cool, to refrigerate. Should we have this person go into the care of the funeral home? And again, it depends what state you live in. Every state has their specific rules. So it's important for you to check into those things. There's a wonderful website called Natural Home Funeral Alliance. And they're so good at breaking down which states allow you to transport a loved one. Because some people say, I really would love to go to the hospital and have my dad in my van and bring him to the funeral home. I mean, it saves money, but also some people feel like, no, that's for his last ride, and I want to play the music he'd like, and that'd be a really special need thing for us to do. Well, guess what? In most states, you can do that. You just want to find out your legalities. And what I found is sometimes calling your local funeral home isn't the best place to go for information, because what they'll tell you is what they always have done or what's on their general price list or what they deem as normal. When we have so many rights as individuals, that person is, in essence, your property. That person is your family, and you can really do whatever you want to do. So find these things out if you do want to be a little bit more hands-on than you think you can be.
Okay. Well, it's truly a beautiful concept. I do embrace that part of it. I'm still kind of getting there with the rest. Now, you say it's very important if you're going to do any type of green burial to decline the embalming. Why?
It kind of is a catch-22. If you're going to have a natural burial and you want the body to break down naturally, and you want all the juicy goodness inside the body to go ahead and repopulate the soil and dance with the fungi and dance with the algae and really generate that soil to be into a better state, having toxin chemicals inside of you doesn't really make that a just situation. Mm-hmm. Also, if you're going to use a cemetery that allows natural burial, that cemetery is going to have some rules that say, okay, if you're going to do that, where you're just going to allow your loved one to be either in a shroud or a sheet or on a board, in a cardboard box, simple pine casket, what we need from you is not to have that person dressed in plastic or polyester. We need something that's going to break down naturally. We need not to have metals in the casket and toxic glues. And we also need that body not to be full of preservatives. We need this person to naturally all break down so the ecosystem really benefits from this. There's so many points to this, too. It's really giving back to the environment. It's really that concept of that last environmental heroic act we can do is go green, literally going green by placing your body back into the earth.
Okay, and folks, she's talking, you know, I guess you can have a pine box if you want, or a box if you want, but she's literally talking about, you know, wrapping in the shroud. In fact, she talks in the book about one family, I don't remember who they were, and they buried their dad, and they shrouded his body, and the lowering straps were part of the shroud, and once he was loaded into the grave, they placed that on the straps on top of him, and, you know, finish the rest of the process. But, you know, reading the story in the book, it was a very beautiful story. But, Elizabeth, I'd like for you to share the story of Bill, Ralph, and Jim and the cherry tree and their dad. At least I think it was their dad.
Yeah, right. So I went out to this family's house, which I tend to always do. If a family wants to have a natural burial, it's normally prior to the death. They've thought about this. The person's probably dying in the house or under hospice care, and they're thinking about this concept, and they know I'm this green reaper or this green burial lady, green mortician, they call me. Mm-hmm. So I run the address by the planning and zoning department of the local county just to get their blessing for them to say, okay, fine, we see this parcel, looks okay. And then I physically go out to the house and take a look. And it was a really special day to meet these three brothers. We were on this old deck, and the wind was blowing perfectly. It was one of those beautiful, breezy days where all was right in the world, and there were some big cherries overhanging on the deck. And we were sort of eating the cherries and talking, and kind of nobody was saying, how cool is this? But it was just that feeling of, wow, this all feels right, and it just felt just neat and great. And we went and prepared a space, and the brothers, it was a really healing moment for them. They were close, but this really made the closeness really happen, because one person was able to prepare what container Dad would be in. The other brother went out and, you know, found the space in the yard and did the digging, and then the other brother kind of came out and helped, and then the other person, I mean, everybody kind of had their job. The three of them worked as a tribe. One person, you know, helped carry Dad out. They all just sort of did their pieces. And at the very end, when they laid Dad into the space, they were shoveling and telling stories and laughing about childhood, and it was like this real healing for them, and it was really beautiful, and it was really sort of like what burials, funerals should be. It's all about the living, and it's all about the fact not only do you have to find your new normal, but you're celebrating the life of that person, no matter how you're doing it. If you're deciding you're not going to bury them, but you're going to have a cremation and maybe scatter ashes, or maybe bury them, or maybe take them home and, you know, place them underneath your favorite rose bush, to stop and to reflect and to say, hey, this person was here on the earth and they mattered, and this is why I valued them, and this is what I learned from them. And those are really, really special times for me to be able to be a part of, because I'm sort of in the background. They know I'm there as a legal person and the helper, but they really run the show. And to really just see people work together and know and that they can empower themselves, that they did this for their dad, the last thing they could do for their dad, that's pretty cool to be a part of.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. Well, folks, we're speaking with Elizabeth Fournier. She is the author of the Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. Elizabeth, we talk about affordable. How affordable is a green burial compared to what we would consider a traditional burial, just say here in the United States?
Well, you can save an exceptional amount of money. lots of money. I find the families that I serve in Oregon, a lot of them love the concept of the environment because they take care of their bottles. They go back to the store and they shop with their cloth baskets and they think about the possibility of driving Priuses. But there's also another huge chunk that really loves the concept of natural burial because of the economical savings. And you're not buying a big expensive shellacked casket made out of hardwoods, or you're not buying that metal casket that's, you know, the upwards of $5,000, $10,000. So just with that piece of merchandise out of the puzzle, think about how much savings that is.
I was just going to say that, you know, it's wonderful to honor the person who has passed on, but if you're putting all the money into the ground, does that really serve anything?
No, it doesn't. And I can speak to two parts of that. One is I was with a family recently, and they decided to use a cardboard box. And the reason why they did that is their dad was a product of the Depression, and he was a man who saved every scrap of cardboard. And so the children thought it was so fitting to sort of assemble this with non-toxic glue and make a cardboard box. Well, when he was on the lowering device in the backyard, you could hear the cousins and the neighbors kind of snigger and make comments of, gosh, they really must not like their dad. I can't believe this. So I decided to use this as a teaching moment. And before the service started, I stood up, and I always tell people to please silence their cell phones because you'd be surprised at all the people who forget to turn their cell phones off. And we talked about we did some housekeeping of, you know, where the bathrooms are and all those things. But I got to address the fact that this man is placed into this vessel and explain why the family chose this and why they wanted to do this, and that this family could probably have the means to buy him the most luxurious casket ever. But the man that we see before us that we're celebrating and honoring for the day, this is what he would have wanted. And it really helped silence those voices that were really giving the family a bad time for being so cheap, because really they were being environmental and economical and really speaking to this man. When you talk about all of the items that are in the ground, oh my gosh, Monique, would you believe that all of the metals that we bury annually in the ground, we could rebuild a Golden Gate Bridge every year?
Really? Every year?
A Golden Gate Bridge annually for all the metal that goes into the ground with all the cemeteries. All the concrete that's poured to make those grave liners. And what a grave liner is, it's a simple concrete box that already sits into the ground. Most people don't see it. And it's there to sort of fortify the grave so no soil sinks and you have that pristine sort of memorial park look where nobody has to go back and backfill any of the earth on there. Mm-hmm. All of that concrete, we could have a one-lane highway across the United States. I mean, these are resources for the living. All the transportation, we could carry ourselves back and forth to see people while they're still alive, yet we find the need to put this in the ground where it's just going to sit and do nothing. Doesn't really make any sense, does it?
Not at all. But when did all of this come into being? Because we're going to talk in a little bit about, you know, other cultures and what they have done. But when did it come into being that you have to have a vault or a grave liner, that you have to have this strong steel casket and all of this because you don't want the bugs and whatever to eat the body?
Oh, I would say the Civil War, and that's really when the advent of embalming came in. Yeah, prior to that, if you think about that, we always had those Victorian homes, and we always had that front parlor, and when someone passed away, the women of the family would go and they would take care of that loved one. They would bathe them and dress them and have them in that front room for the visitation to happen. And then when that was finished, we would go ahead and put that person on a cart or on a buggy and, you know, bring them down to the churchyard or bring them to the backyard and have a simple burial. And this is really what we did. We might have a neighbor fashion a quick box out of some simple wood or a tree that was felled. We'd maybe use a sheet from the bed to go ahead and wrap somebody in a sheet. That's really what a shroud is. It's just a piece of material. We would make that happen, and then we'd go ahead and make this all simple, and of course we wouldn't use any embalming. But then what happened was the Civil War came. Boys were killed on the battlefield. We wanted these boys to get back to their respective states, which were more at a far distance. We had to get them on the trains to do that for transport. So some doctors came up with the idea of preserving. So formalin and some different preservatives and formaldehydes came about. And this became something where they saw it as pretty money-making because these doctors were paid pretty good money to do this. So, of course, since something was money-making, people wanted to get in on the deal. So we had schools. And that's when mortuary school started. And we had the boys that would go to school to be morticians. And you kind of could see where this is progressing here. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon the boys established funeral parlors. And rather than the front parlor being the family parlor that we would use, we would come and get somebody and take them out into the funeral parlor. And then we thought, well, hey, we have this business now, and we can preserve your loved one to have them look lifelike, and we can go ahead, and while we're at it, why don't we go ahead and have some goods and services? So we got the more expensive caskets, and then cemeteries started getting in on the act and thought, well, we can make this whole green area out here, and what we can do is break it up into little graves, and then we can have all of these graves with little boxes inside to make them fortified, and then we can have this sparkling green sort of sexy memorial park so people will want to see the value and spend the high prices to buy graves. And it went on and on and on. So now, late at night, you watch commercials on TV that say an average funeral is $10,000, $12,000 because of now no longer doing this in the home parlor. We use the funeral parlor.
Yeah, so all that added expense for nothing. I know when my mom passed away, she was cremated, and she passed away in, like, February, and we had her celebration of life service in March. And it worked out perfectly because we had it at her favorite restaurant, and everybody ate and drank and were merry, and there wasn't any of that heavy, sad energy like there was when my dad passed away. You know, we had to wait 5 days for family that we never saw in our life and would never see again come and look at the body. And, you know, it was just a horrendous, horrible time, you know, where with mom it was kind of done pretty quickly. And not that we were trying to forget, we were just like trying to get her settled and then go on and get ourselves settled and move on with life. So sometimes you just never know. Folks, we're speaking with Elizabeth Fournier. Again, her book, The Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. If the subject bothers you, as it has bothered me, get over it. Don't let it bother you, okay? I didn't even think I'd be able to make it through this interview, okay, to be honest with you. I'm doing okay. Plus, the information that she is sharing with us is crucial for today. Crucial. I mean, you know, think about it. With the economy and the way things are going, who has 25, 30 grand to put into the ground? You just don't anymore. So it's time to educate yourself and your families and put your wishes out there. And in the book, she shares ways on how you can capture your wishes so that they can be followed. There's a lot of information in this book. So please, you know, Amazon, wherever books are sold, go get it, okay, because there are many, many different options, as she likes to say, outside of the box options. Outside of the box. So, Elizabeth, what is a death doula?
Death doula. Yeah, that's a great, great, great thing. Now, we used to have this idea of when somebody's born, you have the doctor and the nurse, right? Mm-hmm. But then we had birth midwives, and they were people who helped, and they were that intermediate person who was there and helped you with the delivery. We have that now, too. A death doula is that person who's going to be helping. We have a new name. The new hip name in the industry is end-of-life doula. Okay. And that's what we call them. So just like the midwives that help, they are there. They have really helped families to be really present with someone as they die, to really help with all of the post-death needs. Mm-hmm. And there are another set of helping hands there. They're really there to help emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. They really give to the patient and to the family and the community, really during all stages of the death, the dying, the grieving, and even the burial. And they're not licensed funeral directors. They're not licensed nurses or registered or certified nurses. It's not hospice. But it's somebody who can really take on a lot of the tasks and really kind of provide that grassroots response to that cultural alienation that we really feed from with death and dying and all that post-death care. So you can hire them to do various tasks. They can fill out paperwork. They can transport your loved one. They can help organize. And then they can also help the person. They can transfer to, once the person has died, they can now help the family sort of get on their path and figure out what their new normal is. So it's a wonderful person to help. There's also home funeral guides, and these are people who are really a little bit more hands-on with the body, and they'll help you decipher how to wash, how to dress, go on to maybe how to plan your remembrance, your celebration, and how to really officiate some of these things that are going to be happening in the house and to organize those things. So it's neat how all these different groups have different roles, and these are all jobs that can be taken on by a family member who wants to step in and do these things. But sometimes it's a little bit easier to acquiesce to somebody who has a lot of home funeral experience. And again, that the National Home Funeral Alliance has so much information. It's a really great place to go for resources.
Okay. Now, in your book, you share many different, I'm going to call them tidbits, about different societies and different religions and what they do. Okay. I would love for you to tell the audience about the Philippines and the hanging, the cliff hanging coffins, and then the sky burials in Tibet.
Yes. Okay, so different cultures have done different things over the years. And in the Philippines, something which happens there a lot is there's a wonderful big wall, and you'll see this picture a lot. There's some wood caskets hanging from it. And people often don't know what that is, but that's actual bodies inside these caskets. It's when somebody will pass away, the younger generations of the family, it's their responsibility to get a box, put the person in that box, and help get them up the wall. The concept is they'll be kind of hanging on this wall, and then they will be closer to the heavens, closer to where they need to be, and then kind of giving back to the universe, giving back to the earth. Sky burial is sort of opposite. We think of, you know, sky burial, well, you're up there in the air on the cliff, you must be sky burial. But sky burial is really something with turkey vultures. And that's something that we don't do here in the U.S., but I've heard from a couple people during book readings that they're trying to bring this back. Some people tell me they really want to spearhead this concept. But we have a body which ultimately will be fed to the birds. This body will be brought up into an area. Tibet does this a lot because they have a lot of these turkey vultures. There'll be somebody who actually helps get the vultures starting to eat the body. People will come out and they'll physically help with the bones and sort of do a little bit more physicality with the body. Again, don't want to be too graphic because that's not why all your listeners are tuned in today. But ultimately, when people say, feed me to the birds, or just toss me out, you know, on a cliff and let nature have its way, this is probably as close as we can get to that concept. And not a legal form of disposition here in the United States, but again, neither was the idea of burial at sea, or neither was the water cremation, as we do in 12 states here in the Union. People just slowly decide they have this fantastic idea to compost bodies or make bodies freeze-dried. They come up with it. They get the science behind it. They get a movement. They get things lobbied. Things get voted into state rules and statutes and regulations, and off we go.
Okay. Well, you know, in your book you talk about, and maybe this is something I should visit a time or two, a death cafe where people actually get together and talk about death. I guess it was started in England in 2011. Do they have them here in the United States?
They have them all over the world. It was a really neat concept. There's a man named John Underwood, and he actually passed away recently. He was a very young man in his 40s. But this is something that he started, and he wanted to have the concept that we can get together and we can just have an informal gathering of people who have a curiosity about death and have a desire to discuss it. And there's really no agenda for these meetings. There's a website, deathcafe.com, and you can look at it and you can figure out where a death cafe is near you. You can also look at it and figure out the basic rules and tenets to start your own. You can have this in a private house. You can have it in a restaurant, in a meeting hall, or you can go to one that's already sort of established. And it's ultimately strangers coming together. They're going to eat some cake and drink some tea and discuss things. And the objective is to increase awareness of death with a view to help people make the most of the life they live now. So it's not really a funeral planning session or a grief workshop or funeral director is selling their goods and services. It's just people wanting to come together and be heard and have a voice and be able to talk about things they've heard about or what they're thinking about, because not everybody has a group of friends established that are comfortable hearing these things and listening to this stuff and asking these questions. So it's a lot of people who've had somebody pass away recently or maybe going through the steps of hospice might show up looking for support too. So I've been to several of these, and it's a real mixed bag of the type of people who are there, but I've always walked away with a greater appreciation for humans, for community, for life in general. So I really think that they're on the right track doing the right thing.
Wonderful. And folks, you know, if you have the opportunity or the inclination, check it out. It might be something of value to you. Now, when I leave my physical body, I've told my family I want to be crispy critters, and to me that's cremation. But what is the difference between a funeral pyre and cremation? I mean, I guess in the end they both do the same thing, but what's the differences?
Well, I think the difference would mostly be the funeral pyre is something that we legally do not do in the United States. And if you do pass away in one of these states and are going to be doing something here, we have to follow the rules and regulations.
Okay.
The only outdoor funeral pyre that we have is in Colorado. It's in a place called Crestone, and they have that regulated where they can provide an outdoor cremation. And that is a real wonderful thing for generally going green. It's really carbon neutral. They're burning wood. They're not doing gas or propane. You're not embalmed. But, of course, there needs to be a permit. They only have so many of these per year. They really try to regulate it to be people locally in the area so people locally can take advantage of this.
Okay.
And standard cremation, which is flame cremation done at a crematory, this is something legal in all 50 states. This is something that we've done for many years. And on the West Coast, we're at an extremely high percentage of people who choose this. It's definitely high 70s of people who choose, not 70 years old, but 70 percentile.
Right. Yeah.
It's very close to 80% of people who really choose this just because of the idea of not wanting to spend money and wanting to be environmental. However, studies are showing cremation is not the most environmental way because of the carbon footprint, because of all of the gas, all of the heat, everything that goes in to generate the heat up to that 1,800 degrees and basically hold that there for a while. Also, sometimes the funeral director doesn't catch the fact there's a pacemaker, there's a defibrillator inside the body, so that radioactivity goes out into the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And also the ozone layer gets really full of our cavities, are the mercury that's filling those teeth, that will go out into the universe, which is really not great, bad stuff. And then, of course, it rains, it comes back down to the earth, and you have to think if it comes down to the earth, animals are eating that, the fishes are eating it, we're going to put that back in our bodies, so it's a never-ending cycle. So there are several states now who take care of cremation in a water-based form, and the names differ. It's either aqua dissolution or biocremation, alkaline hydrolysis. There's lots of words. So if any of your listeners want to check out eco-cremation or biocremation, they'll come up with different names. We haven't really settled on what yet universally. But this is the idea of taking care of cremating a body, but doing it with water, doing it with a nice water bath, with some warm water. We use some potassium chloride. The body breaks down naturally, and then we have a skeletal form. Our skeletal form kind of goes down smaller but makes cremated remains. And then we have the same end product as we would with a traditional cremation. We now have cremains in an urn back to a family, and they can do whatever they want with them, the same way they would with your standard cremated remains. We just got there with a different process, which is really eco-friendly, and it's pretty fantastic that more and more states are voting this into their legislation and therefore having this as a statute and something which they can use as a legal form of disposition in individual states. And in Oregon, we can do this, and it's really a wonderful option to provide families.
Okay, well, I'm going to check that out. So maybe I'll change that from crispy critters to watery something.
I think you'll come up with something super creative. It'll be great.
Oh, of course. And of course, that's all going to be outlined, you know, in my paperwork and notarized so that they will fulfill my wishes. You know, our time is interesting, Elizabeth. Our time is up, and I still want to talk more. So, I mean, Wow.
That's a great sign.
It is a good sign. And folks, I got to tell you, I did some healing with working through this and get the book, especially if you have fears around the dead body. I'm not afraid of death. I am afraid of the dead body. Why? I don't know. I just am. So, Elizabeth, what words of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience since we've had such a wonderful visit, in my opinion, together?
Thank you. I really think we need to go easy on ourselves and take care of ourselves more. When somebody in your life is passing away, we really need to get our sleep and drink our water and eat and give our body nutrition. We tend to forget that we are still here, and it's not taking away from that person that's dying to still care for ourselves. So just something really important, the water, my goodness.
Okay. Well, folks, check her out at her websites, Elizabeth Fournier. I'll spell that, ElizabethFournier.com or thegreenreaper.com. Elizabeth, I thank you for your time and attention today, as well as the audience. The divine in me honors the divine in you. Folks, if you're looking to make your life a little bit better before you do pass away, give me a call. Consultations are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make that call, 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of a green burial. You're loving the earth and you're loving yourself and your family. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.